This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Diving beneath the headlines on the MBTA this week is another tranche of closings. More bad news about new red and orange line trains have pushed what has become a perennial public problem back into the news cycle. Everyone knows the stakes at this point.
The results of an underinvested, mismanaged transit system came to a head with a death on the red line, a fire on the orange line, and a month-long shutdown of the Orange Line that did not yield the promised results.
We don't have a functioning economy without a functioning public transit system. It is just a top priority.
Jim Rooney of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce there excoriating the T in his annual State of Business address a few weeks ago, sound courtesy of the chamber, and then Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey on Radio Boston earlier this week. So the question is, with troubled finances, a bad contract for new trains, shutdowns for basic repairs ongoing, a new governor, and the search for a new general manager underway, can the Commonwealth get the MBTA back on track? Well, here to help us try to answer that question, Boston Herald transportation reporter Gayla Cawley. Gayla, it's your first time with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
And then two folks to welcome back. First, Chris Dempsey, who's a public transit advocate and former candidate for Auditor of Massachusetts. Welcome back, Chris.
Great to be here.
And on the line, we have Daryl C. Murphy, who you may know as the host of The Common, but not only rides the T, but is actually the former transportation reporter for us here at WBUR. Hey, Daryl, thanks for joining.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. So, Gayla, I am going to start with you because you had this story this week. It actually led to the conversation I had with Maura Healey on Wednesday where she made that comment. This is about CRRC, which is the company that has the contract for the new orange and red line trains. You found some documents, got to hold some documents. Give us the headlines on what you found.
Right. So I was able to get a public records request of minutes from closed door meetings between the MBTA and CRRC representatives from 2022. So that revealed just a host of problems that have happened with orange and red line car production, just some issues with lack of delivery. Only 9 of 34 married pairs, which is 2 car sets of orange line cars, had been delivered.
I'm sorry, I am, because it's beneath the headlines, going to take a moment to chuckle at the fact that they're called married pairs, because I did not know that.
Right.
I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
So far beneath their goal for the year, as far as the goal that CRRC had, some instances of pushing cars through inspections, saying that the cars were fine when repairs weren't being made that were identified as defects by the MBTA. So forms were filed by CRRC to say that those repairs had been made when they hadn't been. Quality issue item reports had been force closed without repairs being made for those.
So force closed, meaning they found a way to close the ticket without fixing the problem.
Right. So in one instance, according to the minutes, there had been 14 issues found with one particular car. And that quality item report was force closed.
So do you know, is that car now one of the cars that the MBTA is using?
I'm not. I don't know that for sure. But I know that that had been a common problem, according to the minutes.
So Chris Dempsey, I'll turn to you. I mean, I know you follow the reporting closely. I know you're aware of Gayla's story. When you read that, right, was that a moment for you of, well, yeah, or was that a moment of, seriously?
Well, first of all, I want to compliment Gayla on her reporting and unearthing that, and then you, Tiziana, for making sure that you're pushing the administration to grapple with it and deal with it. That being said, I know that they're aware that this is maybe the most crucial transportation issue facing the Commonwealth today, is getting these red and orange line cars back on track. You chuckled at the concept of a married pair, and normally we like to celebrate long-lasting marriages. We have red line cars that have been married pairs running on our system for over 50 years. We're celebrating their 50-plus year anniversaries now. That is not a good story to tell. We have to have these new cars so that we have basic safety and reliability on these two core lines, the red and orange lines, two of the busiest lines in the MBTA system. Unfortunately, while I'm so impressed with Gayla's reporting, it was not surprising, because we know that this has been a challenge for many years now. In 2018, these cars were supposed to be rolling off the line on a regular basis. We were supposed to have now something like 200 or 300 of those cars. We have only 90 delivered. So we're behind, and there's no sense at the moment of momentum to get it back on track.
Okay, so I hadn't been planning to ask you this question, but I'm going to now. You ran for auditor, right? Would, in most circumstances, would that level of performance on a contract not trigger basically, you know, a major reconsideration of the contract?
Well, it absolutely should, but here's the problem with big contracts like this. We're seeing this with the Red and Orange Line cars. We're seeing it with the MBTA's fare collection system, which is another billion-dollar project. You don't have a lot of alternatives. So the idea of going back out to the marketplace and basically restarting this process is incredibly daunting. You might need 8 or 10 years to go from starting that process to when those cars would be delivered. And we don't really have 8 or 10 years to wait with these existing Red and Orange Line cars that have been, again, running for now 50 plus years.
Okay.
And so that's the challenge here is you want to put as much pressure on the contractor as you can, but you also understand that you don't have other great options for moving somewhere else.
Okay. So Daryl Murphy, that then raises another question as I'm listening here and sort of connecting the dots. We did have Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey on Wednesday. One of the things that we asked her about was, from Gala's reporting, we'd learned that the governor had a team together that was going to, you know, sort of get on the ground and look at what was happening at CRRC, try to get the issue solved and push us forward. And I asked her about that team. Here's a little bit of what she said, Daryl.
The team will have a constant presence at the facility right now.
So
that's going to be an ongoing process.
There.
Physically, you have to be physically there.
So, Daryl, you know, I'm mindful that you've covered transportation in two different states, two Northeast, you know, regional states. This relationship between a governor and a legacy, and I'm using that term on purpose, a legacy system and a legacy office like a T, right, or public transit, how much leverage, even with human beings on the ground staring at it, right, given the being over a barrel that Chris Dempsey just told us we are, how much leverage can a governor have, Daryl?
I mean, I don't know. In my experience, you know, coming from Philadelphia, the governor, I don't know, the governor didn't have that much say because it wasn't, there wasn't the same state oversight, right? But here in Massachusetts, it seems like the state has a direct relationship with the MBTA. So I would imagine that there's got to be a lot more sway there than if it didn't. So, yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to see just how much of a heavy hand Maura Healey has in this process of getting these trains back on track.
And I'm going to stay with you for a minute, Daryl. You know, you are well tapped into riders. And I'm thinking about before a meeting, Maura Healey got on the T, you know, rode the T. I remember during the final debate asking she and Jeff Diehl about their sort of T ridership experience. It really just wasn't there for either of them. What riders, we're having all this conversation, what's the contract like and the new trains and should they be in blah, blah, blah. Have we reached a level for riders that is, well, funny almost? We're going to do a segment later in the show about when you can laugh at things when because they're so bad. Is that where we are, Daryl?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. You know, first and foremost, you're already going to be there because you are a major city with a legacy transit system that, you know, a lot of people depend on, right? So whatever the system does that's not perfect, it's going to be fodder for riders, right? But the MBTA, you're going to have that. Plus, it's a little bit more serious, you know, because really serious things happen. You know, trains catching fire, people getting caught in the door and dying, collisions and stuff like that. So yes, it gives people a lot to talk about and a lot to be concerned about, frankly, you know, and then you add on top of that some of the traffic issues that happen in the city that kind of could impact things like bus service and stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot to talk about, you know, and in a sense, I guess for the MBTA, you know, people laugh to keep from crying. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, again, we're going to talk about that in more depth a little bit later in the show. So, Gala, I'm going to turn back to you. You know, you're reporting with the Boston Herald. We've got this money problem. And I wouldn't be surprised, Chris, if your eyes kind of glaze over at this point, given the number of times we've talked about these numbers problems at the T here on Radio Boston. You know, we are talking about a $200 million projected budget shortfall next year. Right now, the T is spending $270 million roughly in federal money to help offset. You've done some reporting on revenues, you know, fare revenues and where they are, whether we can even compare them to pre-pandemic levels anymore, because maybe that's just a thing that doesn't exist anymore. Gayla, in your reporting and in your sense of tracking this, where is the key money pain?
I think what you just touched on is the issue. Before the pandemic, pre-pandemic, fare revenue was covering about 42% of the budget. Now it's covering about a quarter. So there's talk of reduced fares, free fares, but the budget right now is largely dependent on fare revenue, the way that it's set up, the operating budget at least. So when you lose that big chunk of revenue in the budget, that really brings a shortfall. So right now, the MBTA is relying on sales tax revenue, which is non-operating subsidy revenue, and one-time federal revenue, which is pandemic relief funds that are going to be running out in the next year. So once that happens, once those federal funds run out, you're going to be in a real situation where you're going to have hundreds of millions of dollars of budget shortfall.
So, Chris Dempsey, I'm actually literally picturing one of those silent movies, right? You've got your dun, 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 and the train is down the track and there's a cliff and everyone's silently going, oh, no. That's kind of where we are.
We're certainly headed that way. Without getting too wonky here, Tiziana, the way to think about the T is it's a organization with very high fixed costs and very low marginal costs.
So let's get that even simpler,
yep.
Right?
So
fixed cost means what? Marginal means?
The stuff that you have to spend on every year, whether you have zero riders or a million riders. It's track, it's stations. No matter how many people are moving through the system, that stuff is all going to cost a significant amount of money. The marginal costs are low, meaning every additional rider that takes the system is a very, very low cost, almost nothing, really. And so when you have a 20 or 30% shock to your ridership, which is what we have today, we're 30% below what we were pre-COVID, that's all very low reduction in cost for the T, but a significant reduction in revenue. And that's creating this structural deficit that we see. And so what we need from our elected leaders, from Governor Healey, and I think she's been very good on transit and will continue to be good on transit, we need from her on down to the local level an all-in effort to say we need more people back on the T, and we're going to support it with policies that encourage transit ridership and really try to better balance our incentives between transit and driving. We've got the worst traffic congestion in the country, or at least top five, depending on whatever standard or metric you use. We've got to find ways to rebalance that and get people back on the T.
So, Daryl, to underscore that, so Jim Rooney actually echoed the worst transportation piece that Chris Dempsey just said in this conversation he had with the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. Again, this sound is from the chamber. Here he is.
The transportation headaches aren't just on public transit. Drivers have them, too. Boston is the second most congested city in the United States and the fourth in the world. It is unacceptable that the options for commuters is to choose between nation-leading, really world-leading, congestion on highways or nation-leading safety incidents on public transit.
To wit, Daryl, we need more riders to solve the structural problem, but A, fewer people going to work every day, and B, if the fact that being in a car is a living nightmare is not enough to put people back on the T, Daryl, how do we solve the chicken and egg problem here for riders? You know, my red line train to Gayla's reporting is more than 20 minutes slower than it should be, and people die. And, you know, how do we solve that chicken and egg problem?
I wish I knew. but I mean, just from sitting here as somebody who rides SEPTA, it's not SEPTA, it's the T, somebody who rides the MBTA, you know, I take the green line, the red line, I ride the buses. I think it just has to work, you know, that's what it all comes down to. People trust these systems to get them where they need to go safely and reliably. And that's always what it comes down to. You know, people pay for this stuff. A lot of time and resources is committed to this. And that's all people want. They just want to get a return on their investment. You know what I mean? It just has to work. And it's as simple as that, you know?
So, Gayla, with that kind of ringing in my ears, right? Listen, there is no amount of conversation we can have on this that ever covers it all, ever, right? I feel like we'd have to sit here and do a week of hour-longs, and at the end of the week, we'd be like, but we didn't talk about X, right? So this is a super complex problem. But I've got to believe that in your reporting, there are a couple of threads you're following because you're like, this is the thing, right? This is a couple of the things. Where do you see sort of the real hot points that you want to stay on over these next couple of months because they're kind of key drivers of some way to crawl out of the moment we're in?
Well, I think what the two topics that we discussed as far as the Orange and Red Line train production, I think part of the problem as well with that is that the shells have already been delivered for the most part.
So a shell would be the body of the train that comes from a manufacturing facility in China. Is that where the other facility is? And then gets finished here.
Right. So the shells are made in China and then they're shipped over to the U.S. to be fitted out with hardware and assembled in Springfield. So you have that problem. So I think as far as like getting out of the contract, you'd have to cut your losses, and that's hard to do when you have all of these shells stored. So I think that issue, the slow zones, is an ongoing issue especially with the Red Line right now.
It used to be the Orange Line, right. Now it's more the Red Line.
Yeah, so a lot of work is going on with the Red Line in the next month with that. The new general manager, that's going to be a large issue, finding the right person for that job. There's a search going on right now. According to the governor, it's wrapping up soon. So you really need someone to be able to come in and assess everything that's been going wrong and really take a handle, you know, get a handle on what's been going on, and getting ridership back up and getting the budget back on track. I would say those are some of the key drivers right now.
So Chris Dempsey, I was going to ask you to bring us home anyway, but then the level of nodding I just saw from you when Gayla mentioned the recruitment of this new general manager.
I think it's absolutely essential that we have a new general manager who brings stability to this organization. We've had something like 5 or 6 general managers in the last 6 or 7 years. I've actually lost count and lost track, but it's been too many. It's been too disruptive. We need someone who is going to be the right choice, who's going to commit to be here for the long term. And what that allows you is that stability at the top that then flows to the middle and lower parts of the organization, where people are going to be willing to join that team and be part of an all-in effort to turn this agency around. If you don't have that stability at the top, I think it's very difficult to do that. And so we're all rooting for Governor Healey and her team to be able to recruit the best possible person, whether that's someone locally or someone internationally, the best possible person who can come in and have a steady hand at the wheel in the years ahead to start this slow turnaround process.
All right. Chris Dempsey, transit advocate, Gayla Cawley, Boston Herald transportation reporter, Daryl C. Murphy, host of The Common and former transportation reporter. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Last night, Northampton's city council voted to form a commission to study reparations. Now they join Boston, Amherst, and other communities that are grappling with whether and how to atone for the impacts of slavery and systemic racism. Now, in the reparations conversation, slavery often takes center stage. But what about here in the North? For example, we ended the practice of slavery in Massachusetts in 1783, but in her new book, No Right to an Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era, author and host Jacqueline Jones points out, while the city didn't practice slavery then, it didn't practice equality or equity for its black labor force either. Jackie is here in Studio 2 with us. Jackie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, A, did I sum that up just about right?
Yes, it seems like an odd situation. Slavery was abolished in Massachusetts, as you pointed out, in 1783, and yet Boston was really a post-emancipation society with all the paradoxes and ironies that accompanied that. Many enslaved people who had been skilled workers lost their jobs as skilled workers, and they didn't own tools, they didn't have white customers, and we see actually the Social Division of Labor in Boston saying pretty much the same throughout the 19th century, relegating many black men and women to menial labor. They were doing the same things in 1900 they were doing in 1840.
Yeah, so, and right, that's the nut here, right? In reading the book, a couple of things stood out, right? The first is that regardless of we're limited to the 1800s, roughly, right? In that 100-year time frame, the world of labor that was available to you, the world to be a self-sustaining laborer, the nature of the labor, and the ability to move through the labor force were increasingly, frankly, shrunk for black workers, regardless of whether they had been, to use terms of the time, born free or escaped from slavery in the South or were set free by former enslavers. It felt like it got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yes, look at the 19th century. Look at the dramatic events of the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution here in New England, the Civil War that claimed 750,000 lives, the rise of the retail and commercial sectors after the Civil War. All these were dramatic events that affected the labor force. And yet, again, we find many black workers still relegated to the same kinds of work. Women were servants and laundresses. The men were what they called tenders, which were kind of janitors. They were gardeners. They were doing menial labor for the most part. I do point out in the book, though, those exceptional workers, those who managed to succeed, to prosper, they tended to have white clients or white patrons. The attorney, Robert Morris, for instance, had white clients.
Joseph Clash, who was kind of, I see him as kind of the, with maybe less evil, I don't know, sort of an Al Capone of his time, right? The front businesses like the barbershop that had the clean money, and then the back businesses like what was happening in the dance halls.
Well, he owned a dance hall called the American Hall in the North End. It was very popular with black and white men and women. He was a musician. He was an entrepreneur as well as a barber. He was also a con man and a scammer. And yet he had a very successful career in Boston. He was patronized by well-to-do people. Whenever he was brought before a jury for some violent act he committed, he was declared not guilty. So yeah, he was really a fixture there in the North End and someone who did make some money.
And that's striking because we follow Clash through a lot of this. And one of the things that's interesting about him is that he knows how to work the system, right? You said a minute ago we had these unusual, you know, or exceptional people who would be successful. But part of what was fascinating to me was I did not read in your telling of what it meant to work and be black in the Boston area in the 1800s that merit was it equaled success. So I'll give an example. Octavia Grimes and Reverend Leonard Grimes, who were a married couple who were pastoring 12th Baptist Church. And that really stuck out to me. I mean, Reverend Willie Bodrick II, it comes on the show a lot now. 12th Baptist Church is an active church in Boston. Now, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., when he preached here, preached at 12th Baptist Church. So we're talking about serious history. They were trying to keep that place alive, and they were doing everything they were supposed to be doing, and yet they were borderline itinerant, and not because they didn't do it well, but because we were structured so that they couldn't succeed.
Well, preachers in Boston had high status. The 12th Baptist Church was known as the Fugitives Church. It had a lot of freedom seekers from the South, and yet it was an impoverished congregation during this period. And that is the key here, that the Grimeses, yes, were aggressive in fundraising, in keeping this church alive, but meanwhile, they had a hard time supporting the family because their congregants were so poor. So there was a disconnect between the status of this couple. They had a very high profile in Boston. They were very well respected by white people.
All the famous abolitionists of the day, like Frederick Douglass, for example, this is where people would come to speak. This was like the place. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want listeners to understand that. Please keep going.
Yes. And yet again, this was the lot of many black preachers in Boston during this period. And I follow one in particular, Peter Randolph, who was born enslaved in Virginia, was a blacksmith, came to Boston, became a tender, a janitor, and then found his calling as a preacher, and yet never really had his own congregation for more than a couple of years. And that was because the people he tended to preach to were unable to support him and his family, so he moved from congregation to congregation.
So this was another piece that was interesting, and we're doing a little bit of popcorn here, but it's to round out listeners' understanding of the past who aren't reading the book, right? So that we can kind of bring it forward. One of the things that struck me is you start early on with a group called the Edlow 66. 66 people who are kept in enslaved in the South until the person, the enslaver, dies.
And Carter Edlow, yes.
And in his will gives them their freedom with money they're supposed to get. Mm-hmm. The family then uses the legal system to deprive them of pretty much everything other than no longer being enslaved. They come north, and you test the thesis that if you're free and come north, we're the promised land, right? By tracking these 66 through a couple of generations, and they really embody the systemic closure to prosperity that our labor force in Boston laid out.
Yes, and I think Carter Selden, who was one of the 66, really illustrates this fact. He was relatively successful in the sense that he was a porter, but he was a porter for the same employer for many years. And that stability made him exceptional. Most black workers were casual laborers. They worked for somebody for a day or two or even a couple of hours, and then they had to move on. We look at Anthony Burns, who was a fugitive from Richmond in 1854, came to Boston, and in the rendition hearing related to his case, he recounts, he and another black man recount all the places they went to look for work in the space of about a month. And it was amazing. It was from one place to another in search of these small jobs that would pay maybe a dollar or two. And that was pretty typical of many black workers during this period.
So, you know, to sort of look at the implications of that, one of the things that you put in the book is between 1895 and 1905, Boston's black residents grew from a little more than 16,000 to 21,000, but less than 2% of the city's overall population. It was growing. Only 4 in 100 black families owned their homes, right? So this idea of today, the state of black Boston and the wealth of black Boston, the report from 2015 that shocked so many people, $8 of generational wealth in black families versus a quarter of a million roughly in white families, we really can trace this all the way back.
Yes, certainly the social division of labor is key here to understanding the vulnerability of black families over time. The fact that they were committed or relegated to menial labor, could not make much money, and the fact that their children and grandchildren couldn't hope for much better meant that they were renters for most of their lives, and their children and grandchildren were renters. They were not able to accumulate the assets in the form of property that would enable them to own their own home and prosper overall. And this in contrast to many poor whites who in the antebellum period were able to move up the ladder of social mobility.
And gained political prestige and gained access to the halls of power and benefited from the Industrial Revolution because they were able to access it, et cetera. All right, I want to end in a different place. We do have a few minutes left, but I want to spend a few minutes in this place because the other theme that strikes me is the incredible grace and sharing and networks of support that families, pastors, churches, the black abolitionist community, and I separate them. We've covered on the show the difference between the white abolitionist community in New England and the black abolitionist community, not only showed each other, but generation after generation showed to migrants coming from the South, either through escape or through freedom or, through the post-Civil War, trying to make a way in the greater Boston area.
Yes, this was certainly a collective effort. Certainly we find couples taking in boarders. These are men and women who have fled from slavery. And the boarding house system really is an institution in Boston that helps migrants get their feet on the ground, helps them to find a job. We see a variety of mutual aid societies, fraternal orders that help their members during this period. I found that many adult children remained in their household of origin so that they could help support their parents in their old age. There are charitable organizations, the churches, missionary groups, and all of these are Black groups, as you say. And these help this impoverished, these all help this impoverished population in really dramatic ways.
So this book, I'm looking at the back of the book right now, and I read it. I'm struck by, you know, Taya Miles writing an endorsement of it, Carrie Greenidge writing an endorsement of it, two Black women historians that we've had on the show quite a bit. This is a laborious piece of research you've done here to really paint every corner of the picture with, you know, as a white woman, a white historian telling the story, strong support from Black historians as well about the sort of the veracity and the completeness of the perspective that you tell. So with all of that in mind, as we go forward now in our conversations here about things like reparations, how much do we need to reset the narrative about who we are in New England when it comes to the 1800s, the Black population, freedom, ability to self-determine, et cetera, given your research?
Well, I think as you pointed out at the very beginning of this segment, it wasn't the end of slavery that marked a completely new beginning for Boston's Black men and women. We have to look not only at Boston's role in the international slave trade, but also the social division of labor in the city throughout the 19th century in order to understand the bitter legacy of enslavement that lasted well beyond the 1780s and, of course, into the present.
All right. The author is Jackie Jones. The book is No Right to an Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era. It rewrote a story for me. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And our resident comedians Bethany Van Delft and Ken Reed are back in Studio 2 with us today. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having
us. Yay, we're back.
Glad to have you back.
And you haven't raised the rent, which is nice.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you the thematic question of our conversation today. Why do we sometimes need to laugh when things are bad?
Because things are bad.
Things are bad.
There's nothing else you could do. You'd be completely helpless otherwise. It's a way to, even if it's a false sense of security, it's a way to claim ownership at least a little bit if you can sort of diminish how bad something feels by making a joke.
So you're saying, Ken, it really restores a sense of control.
I think so, yeah. Even if it's a false sense.
Bethany.
I like that. I was thinking more it's like cleansing your brain, or like it's kind of like a meditation. Like you have to,
She's just punching the mic right and left here in Studio 2.
The mic and I were.
She's a physical comic.
I'm a prop comic. Thank you for the mic. I think it's too weighty. It's too much. It's toxic. It makes you sick. So comedy gives you just a moment away from that. It's like a kind of like a reset, like deep breaths resets you to be able to handle whatever's going on now. I feel like comedy, or not comedy per se, but laughing at things, making light of things.
Well, also like to make a joke about something, you kind of have to break it down and understand it.
Interesting. So it's kind of like when we talked about satire.
Right, exactly. So it's kind of a way to like ruminate on something and break it down to its component parts so that you can find sort of the weak link.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
The smart way of doing comedy.
I don't do that.
Yeah, you're a smart guy.
So no, I'm going to call foul on that because here's the truth, right? As the week is unfolding and all of these awful things are happening, I kept wanting to talk to the two of you.
Oh, thank you.
Right?
Oh,
no, it's true. Because there is something about the way with your humor minds, right? There's a critical thinking to get to the, okay, so one, there's a level of critical thinking to make something funny. And I think, Ken, my gut is that it is because A, we have to understand it, and B, I want to control it again.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay, but the second thing is because there's a journey to one when things get funny, mm-hmm. and or can be funny. I'm going to play a little bit of sound. Okay, so we are going to go to September 29th, 2001. I was thinking about this week. September 11th has happened. Saturday Night Live has been off the air, right? Because, of course, it has. It's the first time they're going to try to come back up on air. Mayor Rudy Giuliani, then he's the mayor of New York, is speaking to the audience. Lorne Michaels, the producer, is up there, and the firefighters are on the stage. And the question comes from Lorne to Giuliani. Here we go.
Saturday Night Live is one of our great New York City institutions. And that's why it's important for you to do your show tonight.
Can we be funny?
Why start now?
But it was this very conscious choice. Lorne Michaels understood that he had to get permission from the mayor of New York to be funny again before they could be funny, right? How do you know when it's okay? Like the balloon. And I've got some Saturday Night Live sign on the balloon. We'll play it again, and we will play that actually in a minute. The balloon, it got pretty easy to get funny on that pretty quickly, mostly because it's a balloon.
Yeah.
But there is so much else happening right now here, right here in Boston, and then you step out to Michigan State, you know, in Michigan, and you step wider to the earthquakes in Turkey and Syria. And if humor is something we need, but it can be awful to laugh at something.
Yeah.
How do you know?
I think it's a read the room to a degree. It's time, context, and you have to have a gut instinct for appropriateness as well. So it's not, I don't think there's like a set formula. I think it depends on the scale and the situation.
There isn't a set formula. And also, you know, you can't, for me anyway, joke about suffering, people who are suffering. But you can joke about things that are peripheral to it, you know. Like the earthquake, you cannot joke about the people who are trapped, the people who perished, that you can't joke about that. But you can joke about how immediately after the news is like, well, none of these buildings were up to code and everybody took shortcuts. Like, it is not the time to be bringing up
complaining
that
about
you
building
didn't check
codes.
Angie's List before right. you made your building. You know what I mean? Like, it's not the time for that.
Okay, but so, here's the truth. I'm going to be honest here. I started to laugh at that, and I covered my mouth and backed away from the microphone so no one would know that you made me laugh.
It's a tension breaker, though, as well.
It's a tension breaker, and you're not joking about the horrible suffering of the people.
It's not piling on.
It's making fun of the tone-deaf media who are taking this moment to go, well, none of these buildings are up to code, and then like doing these deep dives on how many buildings weren't up to code. It's not the time at that. It's okay to take a shot at those people.
Right.
You know?
And people who are suffering can make jokes. That's the other thing, because, you know, we as human beings and as comedians, I'll go on a limb and say we're all broken comedians. Yeah.
Yeah. Fair. Except for like maybe Will Ferrell.
Yeah, maybe.
But I think everybody else.
But it's, you know, it's
that was random.
Yeah. It's that defense mechanism. It's a way to control your situation, which is a big thing personally, but also to deal with your own sort of trauma and suffering. And so you not only develop that skill set for yourself, but you need to develop the ability to see that in other people when you're kind of like, this is their trauma to deal with, to make a joke about, not mine.
Right.
I think that's a
sort of like, I can say bad things about my family, but you can't say bad things.
Well, yeah, but you should have told me that earlier. I didn't know.
Delete your tweets, Ken. Delete your tweets.
Okay, so first, let me just remind everybody, we're speaking with Bethany Van Delft and Ken Reed, who we speak with often, local comedians who help us not only sort of process how the world of comedy, especially Boston comedy, goes forward, but also how funny works, right, in a lot of different ways. And we really wanted to talk to the two of you this week at that intersection of trauma and funny, you know, the need for funny in the face of trauma and the perils of and the disrespect that can be attempts at being funny in the face of trauma. I'm going to note for listeners, because that's the subject, we're going to continue to bring up issues that could be traumatic for some. Right. We've talked about 9/11. We have talked about the earthquakes. We're going to continue in that space. And so I just want people to know that there are moments when we want to go to someone and have them make sense of things for us. One of our executive producer, Titus, was talking about Dave Chappelle after the murder of George Floyd and some stand-up that Chappelle did that it wasn't really as much about being funny as it was about processing. How do you two think about processing in public when people expect you to be funny, right, on these traumatic subjects? Or do you just, like, I'm out, I can't do it, I don't do it?
I think it depends on the thing. I think it's a catharsis. So in some capacities, we can be sort of an avatar for processing for people who maybe aren't comfortable talking about a thing. It's Mr. Rogers who said, like, if you can talk about something, you could deal with it. Mm. And a lot of people aren't comfortable taking that plunge. So sometimes comedians will take the hit of, I'll process this publicly to give you something to either find a catharsis with or react to. But it is a fine line because you can't make it all about you, you know, like, oh, I'm so upset that this terrible thing happened to someone else. Like, so it's a balance.
During the pandemic, the show that I produced live, I did it on Instagram Live instead. And through the beginning of the pandemic and all the deaths, and then through the murder of George Floyd and everything, you know, I'm doing this weekly show, bringing comedians on. And when it was serious, we were serious. You know, when we had something serious to say, we said it. But also our natural way of processing is to see the absurdity around these terrible things that are happening. So comedians would be talking to me, or, you know, from basements in their parents' house when they had, like, these great careers in Los Angeles or whatever. And it would be really sad and scary, but they're funny people. And so the bits and pieces that they choose to talk about surrounding this trauma and this grief were super funny. And that's what I think it is. It's, there are so many things in the periphery of any traumatic experience that are funny or absurd. And pulling from those things, I think, is it's healing, it's cathartic, and it's a little bit safer than punching down and you know, really making fun of someone's grief or their trauma.
Yeah, because comedy and horror structurally are identical.
No.
They are completely identical. So I always recommend the Stephen King book, Dance Macabre. It's a nonfiction book he wrote about the structure of horror. And the setup is exactly the same. The punchline is what's different. If you have an emotional connection to a situation, you're very invested in a character and a person. If something funny happens to them, you experience it funny. If something horrific happens, you experience it horror. But in both instances, you're getting a cathartic experience, just with a different, prestige, the way that they show it. But structurally, they're the same. And the example he uses is because of the clown at midnight, where, you know, a clown in the circus is funny, not to everyone, but a clown on your front lawn at midnight is horrific. But in the inverse, a monster on your front lawn is scary, but a monster in the circus is funny. So it's kind of using the same structure with just a different flair.
So the other thing that strikes me about this, I'm going to give a little bit of sound now. So, okay, when we started this conversation and we were like, this is what we want to talk to them about, I'm being really transparent here. The pause is... I am still uncomfortable. I am still uncomfortable that what we are talking about is that intersection between trauma and tragedy and when it's okay to be funny. And I will just tell you, I'm surprised that we're well into this conversation and I'm still uncomfortable. There's a little, when the balloon happened, the first one, not the 17 that we've shot down since then that are like weather balloons. When the first one happened, that had the potential to be quite scary. Right, that's spying, et cetera. It also had the potential to be racist because we have a history of AAPI hate incidents going up here in the country over the last couple of years, especially post-COVID. I've got a piece of sound and then a piece I'm going to describe from a cold open that Saturday Night Live did. So first, this is Kenan Thompson explaining the process of shooting down the balloon. He's being a U.S. Navy general.
I know there were questions about why we didn't shoot it down immediately, but we wanted to wait till it was over the coast so that it wouldn't fall on people or go.
Now, you go on later, you get Bowen Yang as the balloon, and he's kind of backdropped on some water, and he's got this whole, you're just take it away, yeah. Okay? Just take it away.
Yeah, it's very funny. It's very funny humanizing a silly thing.
Yeah. And yet, it's also the case that Bo and Yang make several side references, right?
To being during, Chinese. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the way we're approaching it and how we're approaching the fact that it is a Chinese balloon, right. Et cetera. I also wonder, okay, so there's an arc of when something happens, right? And we're processing the tragedy of it. We're processing the trauma of it. But we're also, forgive me, processing the processing of it. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like comedy can guide or head off the processing of it in ways that might actually be healthy for us collectively. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, you're saying it's preemptive trauma.
Preempting there we go.
Yeah. It's sort of, In the aggregate of all this horrible stuff, something that on its own might just be sort of minorly disturbing is like the last straw sometimes. So something like that balloon. But if we can pick and choose the stuff that's easy target is not what I mean to say, but is appropriate in many ways there.
Yeah, I see what you did there.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I wrote it down on a whiteboard. That's why she said that. But it's easy to knock that stuff off of the worry list, sort of, you know, and sort of gauge the level of bad, especially now where, again, stuff is just constant. And the media, to Bethany's point earlier, with like focusing on the building codes, you know, it's like there'll be all this terrible news and then it'll be like, here's the box office numbers this week. Avatar,
so-and-so
Way of the Water.
So-and-so.
Yeah. And so you're like, what is the scale of things now?
There. So pick that up. How do we process what the scale of things are?
We don't. I mean, honestly, you have to compartmentalize, you know, and you do have to allow the balloon, the cold open, to be funny. You have to let it be funny. You know, if you just lean into the horror of everything, you end up being a real sad person. I was raised by very leftist parents, and we went on many, many, many demonstrations, and we were always describing injustice and fighting against it. And a lot of the people on the left, while they were very good people, they were very unhappy people because they were just leaning into all of this injustice and grief all the time. If you can't find the funny, it kills you, I think. I honestly think so. And you lose the joy of being alive because no matter what's happening, right, it's still a miracle that we're here. Like, it's incredible that we're here and we wake up and we come to be the resident comedians on your show. If you can't find some joy and some gratitude for just even the miracle of being here, then what is the point of all of it?
Bethany really wants you to invite us back.
Yeah. All right. But you know what I mean, right?
I do.
Like if you lean into it, there's just for me there would be nothing.
Right. And scale's a social contract, you know, like we need someone to tell us what they think it is so we can react to it.
Exactly.
And we can all agree.
Yes, thank you. All right. So two things here. One, I want to thank Bethany Van Delft and Ken Reed, our local comedians in residence, for helping us process this one today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And if you're not there yet, if you're still at that place of trauma and grief, or someone you love is and they're struggling with mental health, you can call the nationwide mental health hotline at 988 for support. Again, that number is 988 for support. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.